For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. It is 10 past 8. The morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, we're going to be previewing for you the next American Experience documentary airing on PBS. In part two, I'm going to be speaking with Steve Binder, the man who served as director and producer for the remarkable Elvis Presley comeback TV special of 1968, an incredible night of music making that helped turn around Elvis Presley's career. Here's part one of today's morning show. Tuesday night on PBS, the American Experience series is presenting yet another fascinating documentary, this one entitled A Flood in the Desert. It tells the amazing story of the construction of the Los Angeles Aqueduct, carrying water over 200 miles to the Los Angeles area, a civic engineering feat of great importance. And the construction of a number of major dams was also part of the story of the Los Angeles Aqueduct. Unfortunately, one of those dams, the St. Francis Dam, was designed and constructed poorly and collapsed disastrously in March of 1928, destroying all kinds of property and killing hundreds of people. A civic engineering disaster of epic proportions, perhaps the single worst civic engineering disaster in American history. The story behind all of this is told in fascinating fashion in this documentary, which is directed and produced and written by Rob Rapley, who has done a lot of award-winning work as a documentarian. I have spoken to him on several previous occasions about previous films such as Voice of Freedom, The Secret of Tuxedo Park, Wyatt Earp, and Murder of a President, which examined the story of the assassination of President James Garfield. His latest film, again, is titled A Flood in the Desert. Rob Rapley, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have always enjoyed our conversations. I'm a great admirer of the work that you do as a documentarian, and this latest film is really interesting. And as a lifelong Midwesterner, I have to say I knew next to nothing about this particular story, about the construction of the Los Angeles Aqueduct and the various major dams that are, in a sense, a part of this gigantic civil engineering project, and I knew absolutely nothing about the disastrous collapse of the St. Francis Dam. What about you? When did you first become acquainted with this story, and when did it become clear that this was a wonderful subject matter for American Experience?
Well, we're always looking for stories that illuminate our own world, and obviously one of the most pressing crises that we face is the environmental one, and specifically the the crisis out west with the drought and the general kind of environmental thing going on. And so, as you say, this story is in fact very little known, and that's not an accident. That the it was kind of buried by the authorities at the time, and forgotten, largely forgotten. So I did not know the story too well, but once we kind of came across it, it seemed perfect for as a way of, you know, kind of experiencing their world and understanding ours.
Hmm. So explain the rise of Los Angeles and this civic engineering project. In a sense, which came first? Was it that Los Angeles was growing and this was necessary, or was this constructed and it allowed Los Angeles to grow, or is it difficult to kind of sift between those two?
Well, Los Angeles was, you know, there has been a center of settlement for ages. There were Native American settlements there for, you know, 1,000 years. But the city really started growing with the arrival of the railroads in the late 19th century. And by the turn of the century, it was outgrowing its water supply, essentially. And so there was a fork in the road for them, that they could either remain a small kind of distant second to San Francisco in California, or they had to find a new source of water. And so they came up with this plan to bring water 230 miles, which is, you know, the kind of number goes by, but it's an enormous distance to bring huge amounts of water. This aqueduct would be fed by snowmelt in the Sierra Nevada mountains, so it was eternally renewable. They brought it all the way to Los Angeles, and along the way, they installed generating stations so that the flow of the water, this entire aqueduct, was gravity-fed. And so they installed these electrical generating stations that used the water flow to generate 90% of the electricity used in the city at the time. And so it was actually an amazing plan. You know, it was sustainable even by our standards, and certainly by the standards of the early 20th century. In fact, it was good, so good that the city just blew up after the aqueduct opened in 1913 and grew faster than anybody had imagined. It was just such an attractive lifestyle. So much nicer than the cities back east that were, of course, crowded and polluted. And here's this beautiful place, you know, clean power, lots of water. You know, Los Angeles was already a small city, but a modern Los Angeles really begins on that day in 1913 when the aqueduct opens. Mm.
The man associated primarily with this is a self-taught engineer by the name of William Mulholland, and he figures prominently at every step of this fascinating story. Was the aqueduct his idea, or was he more the person who, in a sense, facilitated its construction and oversaw its coming to reality?
It was not his conception. Fred Eaton, who had been involved with the water department and then mayor of Los Angeles, actually, his father had been a civil engineer, and he kind of, you know, seeing this problem on the horizon, had really conceived of the plan, and he and Mulholland took a camping expedition in 1905, I believe it was, up to the Owens River Valley, which becomes the other end of the aqueduct, the source of the aqueduct. And from there on, you know, the conception was really more Fred Eaton's, but then once the concept has been established, that the design of the thing was very much Mulholland's. And it's kind of incredible. You know, he had no formal training. He had very little formal schooling at all. He left home at 14, and after a particularly severe beating by his father, and left Ireland, went to sea, landed in Los Angeles, which was a small town, and got a job as a ditch digger with the water department, and just worked his way up. And it was 25 years from the time he started as a ditch digger to when he started planning the aqueduct. And along the way, he learned on the job, and he took out engineering books from the library. He had little formal education, but in fact, he was self-taught and was very skilled. The city of Los Angeles insisted that his plan be reviewed by for the aqueduct be reviewed by, you know, a panel of engineers. And they suggested some minor changes, but really, you know, this you know, relatively untrained individual came up with one of the most elaborate civil engineering projects of the era.
We're speaking with Rob Rapley about his amazing American Experience documentary airing tomorrow night called A Flood in the Desert. So this aqueduct allows, it is, in the words of one of your guests, a game changer. It allows Los Angeles to become the fastest growing city in the United States. And ironically and unfortunately, as Los Angeles grows, Southern California, the region, grows progressively drier. And I think one of your guests says something so interesting. This is one of the things that makes this story and your special so timely, is somebody says that Mulholland and this project, the aqueduct, created an illusion of abundance. That is, water was magically appearing, gushing from people's taps, and people had a sense, I suppose, that it was just sort of there, taking it for granted, and that in and of itself was kind of a serious problem.
That's right. The you know, the original plan, the 1913 plan, looked great, and in fact, the aqueduct supplied quite a bit more water than the city needed, and so you know, at its size in 1913, and so it was abundant. It was just more water than anybody needed. So people got used to having lawns and having fountains and just living as if they were in a very different environment. And by the early 20s, when the city had just exploded, you know, grown so much faster than anybody had anticipated, that's when the problems really start to set in, because the aqueduct, because of a multi-year drought, was not bringing in as much water as it had, and so they had to kind of go further, buy up more land, take more water from the Owens Valley, which you know, created a whole series of problems up there. But they, you know, by that time, people had got into the habit of living extravagantly in terms of their water consumption, and that habit, you know, wasn't broken until really, you know, the last few decades.
Hmm. We need to talk about the people of the Owens River Valley and the Owens River Valley itself, which becomes quite a desolate place thanks to the impact of this aqueduct. Explain the way in which this agreement was reached, and how that was a very significant reason why there was such terrible resentment and anger for the people who lived there.
Yeah, I think agreement isn't the word for it.
Right.
What Los Angeles did was, so the Owens River Valley is by the Sierra Mountains, so that's where this the water was coming from. And what they did was buy up secretly, you know, kind of without letting on to their intentions, they bought up sources of water and water rights and land, but did so in such a manner that the locals had no idea what was going on. In fact, one of the main agents for Los Angeles had been hired by the federal government to kind of set up an irrigation plan for the district, so to improve their agriculture and irrigation. And he secretly kind of changed sides and started working for Los Angeles. And so the locals thought that he was, you know, kind of buying up land to help set up this irrigation system, when what he was actually doing was, setting up to take all their water and ship it down to L.A. And nobody was ever, you know, the way this news was broken was a front page huge story in the Los Angeles Times announcing the fact that they, you know, had this amazing plan to bring all this water. And incidentally, even in the story, it says it'll be very bad for the Owens Valley. So that's how they found out about it, and understandably they were appalled. Mm-hmm. The fact remains that at that stage it wasn't going to completely dehydrate the valley. It was, you know, in the early 1920s when they had to go on another buying spree, then the valley really became kind of untenable as an agricultural settlement. Mm-hmm.
One of your guests in the film, I think, says it so well when they say that dispossession is woven into the fabric of the American West. In other words, dispossession is something that we see again and again and again, not just in this story, but in all kinds of other stories in the American West. And even in this specific story, the dispossession is more complicated or more extensive than just the people living in the Owens River Valley at the time, in a sense, losing access to their own water. But those settlers themselves had engaged in a kind of dispossession by displacing Native Americans who had been there before. And I think it's an intriguing choice on your part to include this in the story of your film.
Yeah, for most of the time since the story became public, that was really the story. It was the Owens Valley settlers versus Los Angeles rural versus urban, it became a very fractious and even violent kind of situation there. But what was forgotten was that, you know, the settlers had only arrived in the 1850s and 60s, and there were people who'd been living there for 1,000 years. And in fact, they had set up a quite comprehensive irrigation system, and that was the Paiute, if I remember correctly, the Paiute had a massive kind of territory in the western interior. 100,000 square miles, something, I forget the number, but one particular group settled in the Owens Valley, and so rather than taking up a nomadic lifestyle like their, or not nomadic, but kind of ranging lifestyle like most of their kin, they settled down, built this irrigation system, and lived there for 1,000 years, and then within the space of a couple of decades, they were run out with the, you know, horribly familiar kind of series of atrocities, and it's a terrible story. And so that was the background. That's how the settlers came to be there. So they, you know, they were only there for 40 or 50 years before the city starts to do this. And so, as one of the interview subjects points out, that, you know, what the city did to the settlers had themselves done to the Paiute.
What makes this story take on additional significance is that as Los Angeles grows by leaps and bounds and people have this aforementioned sense of abundance, of there's all kinds of water, we don't have to be careful about how much we use, and so there is an increasingly desperate need for more water, which means an expansion of this huge project and the construction in 1922 of 7 new dams. By this point in time, William Mulholland's standing almost is kind of reached the level of almost celebrity status, and one of the consequences of that is that he is given, in a sense, more and more autonomy and less oversight. As this project expands, Spell out the really serious consequences of that. I mean, what was not done that should have been done when it came to the design and construction of, for instance, the St. Francis Dam?
Mulholland, you know, as I mentioned, when he built the aqueduct in between 1905 and 1913, had to have the city insisted that his plans be reviewed by a panel of experts. By the early 20s, or the 1920s, when he's building these dams, and specifically the St. Francis Dam, which was to be the largest in that set of dams, the St. Francis Dam alone was designed to hold almost a year's worth of water for the entire city. So you can imagine that scale. But so not only by this time, his stature was such that nobody got in his way, nobody questioned him, and but you know, if he had really focused on the St. Francis Dam, there's no question that he could have built a perfect dam. It was a much simpler operation than the aqueduct. But his mind was really elsewhere. They were already looking to what would become the Hoover Dam, damming the Colorado River and distributing the water around the Southwest, including Southern California. And Mulholland was deeply involved in that project, promoting it and kind of laying out a new aqueduct system to bring the water from the Colorado River to Southern California. So that was a huge project. He was away a lot of the time, you know, lobbying in Sacramento or Washington, and scouting this territory and so on. And so his mind was not on the job. And as a result, the St. Francis Dam was really kind of built in a slapdash style. They didn't test the ground thoroughly where the base of the dam was going to be laid. They didn't incorporate safety features that were becoming common, especially in large dams by that time, including drainage wells, so that the water, which as you can imagine is under tremendous pressure around the base of the dam, it tends to seep under a dam and effectively float it away. And so that there had been a few high-profile disasters, and he had built some drainage wells into the center section of the dam, but not around not up the sides, and that would turn out to be a crucial mistake. And finally, and this is a very intuitive mistake, twice during the construction, he raised the level of the dam by 10 feet, so a total of 20 feet, without widening the base. The dam was already being built, and a gravity dam is essentially a big triangle of concrete, and the upstream face is vertical and the downstream face is at an angle, so that the base is much, much wider than the top. And of course, there's a minimum proportion. You need a certain width of base to support the height, and by heightening the dam without widening the base, he created stresses that the dam was simply not capable of holding.
That lack of peer review of the design process proved to be a crucial contributing factor to ultimately the collapse of the dam, the calamitous collapse of the dam on the 12th of March, 1928, which was a devastating disaster, destroying communities, killing hundreds of people, and in a sense, in a moment, destroying much of the reputation of William Mulholland. And your excellent film also explores the consequences in terms of what was still to come with similar kinds of projects. It's a fascinating story that is worth our exploration. You do tell us that good things can emerge from failure, and valuable lessons were learned from this disaster. Can you tell us, in a sense, what was valuable about this?
Well, the lessons that were learned were really engineering lessons for the most part, but also it would be the last time that an individual, especially an untrained individual, would have that kind of control over a major project. The Hoover Dam was already, well, what would become the Hoover Dam was already on the drawing board. And as a result of this, the authorities insisted that those plans be extensively reviewed by panels of experts at every stage of design and construction. They built new safety features. They altered the design of the Hoover Dam somewhat to incorporate new safety features, and as a result, the Hoover Dam has as a structure been flawless. As one of the interview subjects suggests, they learned small lessons from this, but they did not learn the larger lesson, which was, that maybe it would have been great if more people had kind of stepped back and questioned the wisdom of relying so heavily on geoengineering to build a new future. That that even though the St. Francis Dam was not an environmental disaster, that if it had made people a little more cautious, that it would have we'd be better off today.
Right. I think somebody in the film says this project, in a sense, created or led us to an unsustainable future. Someone else says it wasn't so much a question of should water be diverted to Los Angeles, but how is it done? And in at least some respects, it was perhaps not done in the best possible fashion, and maybe not in the fairest fashion. And someone else makes the point, which I think is well taken and timely, that we tend to depend far too much on technology. And maybe coupled with that is we are not always fully mindful of the limitations of technology. I mean, we do not always approach matters like this with a sufficient level of humility and awareness of our own shortcomings and the possibility of sometimes making terrible mistakes.
I think that's exactly right. That, and this is really, I think, the lesson for our own time is, as we seek a way out of the current crisis, the kind of impulse is to look for a geoengineering solution, a one-size-fits-all solution. And in the meantime, we're going to go ahead and we're going to live the way we want, and surely somebody's going to come along and solve this thing. It's possible. I would love to be proven wrong, but it seems more likely, and even if that is going to come along, in the meantime, we should be doing everything we can to forestall the kind of looming crisis, and that will involve more than just one big plan that the engineers come up with. Because the other thing, of course, the story of almost every big scientific innovation is that there are unintended consequences, that in solving one problem, we kind of remove it from the world. We look at that problem in isolation. We solve that, we put the solution into the world, and then there are all these other consequences that we don't anticipate. The era of the big dams, created that sense of abundance all over the Southwest, and it created really unsustainable cities. I mean, it's not sometimes. Easterners will say, well, Los Angeles just shouldn't be there. God didn't intend for, this massive city to be out there. I don't know the mind of God, but I'm guessing that God didn't mean for 4 million people to live on the island of Manhattan either. But so it's not that it shouldn't be done, but it should have been done in a kind of more humble fashion and, you know, kind of more awareness of our own failings and incapacities.
An important story in so many ways. The film, again, is titled A Flood in the Desert, part of the American Experience series. It's going to be airing tomorrow night on Channel 10 PBS in Milwaukee and on PBS stations across the country. And one of the people responsible for this film as producer and director, Rob Rapley. Rob Rapley, congratulations on yet another superb film. And thank you so much for being my guest on The Morning Show. I was really honored to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing the interview I recorded last week with Steve Binder, an Emmy Award-winning producer, director, and writer, who is perhaps best remembered as the director and producer of one of the most exciting and memorable TV specials of all time, the Elvis Presley Comeback Special, which aired in 1968, without a doubt one of the greatest musical moments in television history. This special came along at a time when Elvis Presley had settled into a new life, not performing live in front of ecstatic rock and roll fans, but instead appearing in a long succession of mostly forgettable movies, which also had the effect of seriously blunting his image as a rock and roll icon. This TV special was a chance for Elvis Presley to return to his roots, although his chief handler, Colonel Tom Parker, wanted this to be a sentimental Christmas special. Fortunately, Steve Binder, the man assigned to produce and direct the program, had a much stronger concept in mind. And the special that was ultimately made was one of the most important nights of Elvis's career. Steve Binder has written a very interesting new book that takes us behind the scenes in the making of this groundbreaking special. The book is titled Elvis 68 Comeback, The Story Behind the Special, published by Thunder Bay Press. So, Steve Binder, we welcome you to The Morning Show. I'm so pleased to be able to talk with you about your fascinating book, Elvis 68 Comeback. One of the things that I learned from your book that I knew nothing about was that this very important and well-known Elvis special was part of a trilogy, that there had been a special called Hallelujah Leslie with Leslie Uggams, and then another special called Petula with Petula Clark, with special guest Harry Belafonte. Something happened on that special with Petula Clark that probably played a role in why you ultimately were offered this opportunity to work on this Elvis Presley comeback special. Could you just say a quick word about that controversial, important moment from that special?
Sure. Petula had written an anti-war song, and you have to realize in 1968, the war was raging on in Vietnam, and college students all across America were protesting the war. And so people were very, very sensitive to what was going on politically in the United States. Petula wanted to do a song she wrote herself about being against any war, not just Vietnam, but the whole concept that parents send their children to go fight these battles and die or are seriously wounded. And, you know, when the war's over, flowers grow on the same spot and people forget what actually happened. And NBC did not want me to program that song, but I convinced them that since Petula had written it and it wasn't about just Vietnam, that she should be allowed to perform it. So it ended up that we did it as a duet with Belafonte. And I staged it originally, and we had no audience watching, so I could do multiple takes. But originally, I had Petula coming downstage to Harry's backside after he had performed his segment on the show, and nothing was happening. And I'm an incredible believer that, you know, I don't care how much money you spend on a project, if it doesn't make an audience feel emotional, laugh, cry, do anything, you know, stand up and stomp the floor, you've wasted all your time and your effort and your money. And so I just felt organically it wasn't working, and I went down and restaged it and said, just, you know, when you come down, Petula, to Harry, instead of stopping behind him over his shoulder, which I loved as a director shot, I said, just stand shoulder to shoulder with him and sing the song. And then the magic happened, that all of a sudden Petula started to tear up. You could see it on the close-up, and Harry looked at her, and he saw her tearing up, and so his eyes got kind of watery, and the next thing you know, Petula reaches over and touches Harry's forearm in an emotional part of the lyrics, and all hell breaks loose with this. There's no other way to describe him, but he was a racist representative of the sponsor who objected to a black even being on this special. And as a result, he stormed out of the studio at NBC saying, this will never get on the air. So I went down to the editing room and erased all the other takes that I had done. So the only choice NBC and the sponsor had when they sang that duet was the moment where she reaches over and touches him. And that created an international barrage of press, including Time magazine and Newsweek magazine, who came to the studio just to take a picture of the touch off of the television screen. And that's what triggered NBC to make the phone call to me saying, we have a deal with Colonel Parker to do an hour television special with Elvis, but we can't get Elvis to do it. And we're thinking you're more the same age as him. You're in the music business with your partner, Bones Howe, and you're producing The Fifth Dimension and the Association hits. And you're working with Laura Nero now, and we think you'd make a good team with Elvis and yourself. I originally turned it down because I had already made a commitment to an iconic 50s film producer, Walter Wanger, to do a movie that he sold to a studio. And so I thought I was kind of done with television. And my partner, Bones Howe, said, Steve, you're crazy. You and Elvis would hit it off great. I worked with him once, and I just think you guys would be a great team. And so I called back NBC and said, if you can arrange a one-on-one meeting with Elvis and myself, because I don't know him from Adam other than watching him on the Ed Sullivan Show and seeing him do these corny appearances on Milton Berle's show and Steve Allen's show, where in one case they had a real hound dog in front of him and dressed him up in a tuxedo. And that wasn't Elvis Presley. That wasn't rock and roll. And I understood him when I met him, and I said, I understand you don't want to do television. He said, no. He said, Colonel Parker, when he made the deal with NBC, never told me I had to do a one-hour television special in order for them to release the monies to do my next movie, which turned out to be Change of Habit with Mary Tyler Moore. And so I said, okay, then, you know, what is your turf? And he said, my turf is making rock and roll records. And I said, then you make the rock and roll records, and I'll put pictures to them. How's that? You don't have to worry about the visual.
You know, one of the images you utilize in your book is when you say, I told Elvis that we would approach his special like a tailor making a suit for a special customer, because it was custom made. It would not fit any other artist, but it would be perfectly fitting for Elvis. You tell us in the book that Colonel Tom Parker had a very different idea about what this special should be compared to what actually aired in 1968. Briefly explain to our listeners what his idea was for what this special, this Christmas special, should be.
You know, Colonel Parker never cared about Elvis and his talent. He only cared about, you know, the checks that were coming into him for him to agree to let Elvis do whoever approached him in terms of their projects. And he told me when I first met him that when he saw Elvis, I think it was the Louisiana Hayride or something, he never looked at Elvis on the stage. He just looked at all the screaming young girls out in the audience, you know, going nuts watching him perform. And I think that was all the way through Elvis's relationship with Colonel Parker. I understand they had no social togetherness at all, never went to each other's home for a meal or anything. And I realized quickly after I met Colonel Parker that all he cared about was being the puppet master, pulling the strings. And I was amazed at how, you know, these major executives would kowtow to him and, you know, fear him. And he had nothing in his world that he could use to tempt me to do something I didn't want to do. And I think that really frustrated the colonel to begin with. And his game plan was, the first time I met him before meeting Elvis, he handed me a quarter-inch box with Elvis's picture on it, and it was his gift to disc jockeys all across America of Elvis singing 20 Christmas songs and not even speaking on the album. And I knew I didn't want to do that, leave it to Andy Williams and Perry Como and those Bing Crosby, those kind of guys, to do that. If I were to get involved with Elvis Presley, I wanted to see the real Elvis Presley, the people alluded to but never saw.
Right. And fortunately, of course, that's ultimately what became part of this amazing special. And your book is such an interesting look behind the scenes at what transpired, including what I think is a great idea that you share with us, the verbatim notes of some of the first planning meetings where you are throwing around all kinds of interesting ideas about what this special should be. Tell our listeners about a really important choice that was made. You asked Elvis Presley if he wanted anybody in particular to be involved in the making of this, and he asked for someone named Billy Strange to be, I don't believe, maybe the music director of this, and you agreed to that, although you had someone else in mind. You were happy to accommodate Elvis Presley's request. Ultimately, Billy Strange was fired from the project. Explain what went wrong with Billy Strange and the gentleman who stepped into his place and his reluctance to do so.
Well, it is an interesting story, especially behind the scenes. And what happened was, when I asked Elvis, because he was entering my world, I was not entering the Elvis world. I had my team all put together, going back to when I directed my first Hullabaloo show in New York, where I met Gene McAvoy, our art director. I met Billy Goldenberg, who turned out to be our music director. And I asked Elvis, is there anybody special that you want to join our family? And he said, yes, there's one guy who, he's a guitar player, but he is my music guy, and his name is Billy Strange. And so I agreed, as much as I had in mind using Billy Goldenberg from the very get-go, I had in mind using Billy, I acquiesced and said, okay, I'll hire Billy Strange, which I did. And what I didn't know at the time is that Billy was working with Nancy Sinatra and produced this hit record for Nancy called These Boots Are Made for Walking. And Nancy's label insisted that they get back in the studio and finish the album so they could release it to the general public. So Billy Strange was totally tied up with Nancy Sinatra while I was pre-planning bringing Elvis in to start rehearsals at my offices on the Sunset Strip to start rehearsing for his own special. And every day I would call Billy Strange and say, where are the lead sheets? Where's the music that Elvis is going to be rehearsing to? And he'd say, don't worry, it'll be there, it'll be there. And I finally gave him a deadline and an ultimatum. If the music isn't there on such and such a day, I'm firing you. And he said to me, you can't fire me. I'm closer to Elvis Presley. You just met him. You don't even know him. And so that deadline came and went, and I fired him. And Colonel Parker went bananas as usual and said, you know, I'm not sure Elvis is even going to show up to do your special now, Steve. And Actually, he called me Bindle. Don't ask me why, but that was his nickname for me when he was upset with me. Hmm. And as a result, you know, I called Billy Goldenberg, who I had worked with on Hullabaloo, and he had been musical director for me on the Leslie Uggam special, on the Petula Clark Belafonte special. And Billy said, Steve, I'm a New York kid. As a teenager, he was ghostwriting with Frank Lesser, the great Broadway writer who wrote Guys and Dolls and Green Willow and so forth. And he said, I'm a Jewish kid from New York, and I just don't see myself conducting Hound Dog or Blue Suede Shoes. I said, Billy, I'm not asking you. I'm begging you. I'm on my hands and knees. Come to Los Angeles immediately and do the Elvis Presley special.
And fortunately, he did, and it was all incredible magic. It's all in incredible what was put together. And again, your book takes us behind the scenes of the shaping of this wonderful special, in which, in your words, Elvis Presley rediscovered himself. I want to give you a chance to talk about quickly. I know we're almost out of time. About those iconic improv moments where we see Elvis Presley, in a sense, in a jam session, making music spontaneously. Explain to our listeners what your inspiration was for including this in this groundbreaking special.
When we finally moved out to NBC to start actually taping the show and continue our rehearsals with the dance companies and Elvis and so forth, it was really a situation where Elvis came to me and he said, Steve, do you think you could throw a bed into my dressing room? Because rather than commute to a rented home in Beverly Hills where Petula 3 months earlier had given birth to Lisa Marie, I would really like to live out here and save those few hours of travel time so I could focus and devote it to the special. That was the greatest thing that ever happened, because when we would finish taping or rehearsing, he'd go into his dressing room. We had a couple of pianos in there, and whoever was hanging out would wander in, and he would jam until, you know, midnight or 2 a.m. or whatever, just reminiscing about the old days, and everybody was participating and telling old stories about, you know, when the Vice Squad was at the Pan Pacific Auditorium in California and waiting for him to wiggle his hips so they could arrest him, and stories like that that were really fun. And I said, this is the real show. This is the magic. This is the platinum, double platinum, triple platinum, recording. And so I went to the Colonel and I said, I'm bringing cameras into the dressing room to film this. And the Colonel said, typically over my dead body, you know, you're not bringing cameras in there. But I knew I had to get this on tape, so I kept hounding the Colonel to the point of where, out of frustration, I think, not thinking I would do it, he actually said, okay, if you want to recreate it one day out on stage, I'll let you do that, but I won't guarantee I'll put it into the show. And by that time, he had lost so many battles, you know, still screaming for his Christmas songs. And so it was really a case of where I don't know any other artist, including all the artists I've worked with, that could cold turkey just walk out and do a real improvisation, not a phony one. In fact, my writers ran home when they heard I was doing it and wrote a script for Elvis. And I said, that script is not improvisation. I want Elvis to go out there and not give him a roadmap even. He gets to choose whatever songs he wants to sing. He gets to tell the stories he wants to tell. Elvis asked me to bring DJ Fontana and Scotty Moore, his original drummer and guitarist, in for it. And I think when we started the improv, Elvis was terrified to the point where he wanted to back out. I wouldn't let him. And it was a case of once he got into it and they started really improvising, he forgot he was doing television. He was just having a great old time, like the old days with DJ and Scotty, and really having fun, where it became a cliche, where I almost had to get the vaudeville hook and pull him off the stage, because I think he would have stayed out there forever continuing to jam, which it really was. And there was no roadmap. There was no rehearsal. It was pure, honest Elvis that proved to even all of his peers that he was truly the king of rock and roll.
And we are so grateful for all the great work you did.